word. Since becoming Supreme Pontiff 4 or 5 months ago, Pope Francis has inspired and intrigued his followers in equal measure with stunning gestures of humility, a willingness to speak off the cuff, a beguiling sense of humour, and with messages that suggest that he's about to overhaul the Vatican bureaucracy and lead the church towards more simplicity, a church for the poor. But soon after he was elected Pope, an email was sent by a fellow Jesuit leader in South America warning that the new Pope was a troublemaker who would be a catastrophe for the church. The email is one of many revelations published in a new biography of Pope Francis, the first by a British author, Paul Vallely. We can talk to Paul now. Good morning to you, Paul.
Good morning.
Give us the context of that email. That's quite a devastating response from a fellow Jesuit leader.
Well, the Jesuits in Argentina were very deeply divided by Bergoglio, as he was called, when he was the Jesuit provincial and then the rector of the seminary there. So for 15 years, he was like the key leadership figure in Argentina. And the Jesuits were divided between those who felt that they should be reorientating their work to work with the poor in the slums and in alliance with political movements who were seen as Marxist. And then on the other hand, a group of Jesuits who thought, no, our job is to maintain the traditional spirituality and to educate the elite of Argentina as we've always done. And the Jesuits were leaning towards working with the poor, a strong faction inside the order. Didn't like this, got in touch with Rome, got the old provincial, who was called O'Farrell, removed, and Bergoglio was installed. Bergoglio was a very traditionalist figure, although he's the first pope to be elected who was made a priest after the Second Vatican Council. His formation was before that council, and he was conservative and, most importantly, very authoritarian and domineering in his way of being leader. And people either loved him or loathed him. And
so essentially he was sent in to clamp down on the liberation theologians.
He was very much that. And one of the big controversies about his time was that two Jesuits who were working in the slums were kidnapped by the military and tortured. And that came after he'd had a big row with them and told them that they had to do what they were told because Jesuits are supposed to put obedience as one of their top virtues. These men who'd both been his teachers were arguing with him, and he had said, right, well, you've effectively left the order now, told the Archbishop of Buenos Aires that, who withdrew their licence to say Mass, and the military heard about this and thought these blokes are obviously subversive and went in and picked them up and tortured them. And that's been the biggest thing, but there are loads of little things which divided the Jesuits very bitterly into those who were for him, the Bergoglianos and the anti-Bergoglianos, as they were called.
Well, I want to ask you more about that incident with the two priests, because this is very important and it's a major theme in your book. You haven't just produced a biography here. You've engaged in a little bit of investigative journalism as well, going and looking at this up close. How do you get to the truth about what actually happened there?
Well, his critics accused him of betraying these men and accused him of war crimes, in effect. I've examined the allegations very, very carefully, and my conclusion is that he wasn't complicit in that kind of way, but that he was guilty of locking horns with these men, behaving in a reckless and stubborn way with them. But he was proud. He didn't like it when they said that they weren't going to do what they were told. And he acted in a way which he ought to have known was not politically astute at the time, because he was a political figure and he was well plugged in. He knew what was going on in the military. He knew when there were going to be swoops on areas and that kind of thing. Even there are suggestions. So he wasn't a blundering naive abroad innocently. He actually was someone who should have known that what he did with these men would put them in danger. So he was guilty of a sin, but not a crime, I would say. And I think that subsequently we find that he realizes that, and a lot of his life he talks about mercy all the time and forgiveness all the time. And I think that's autobiographical.
Yes, because you do get the impression that he lives with some sense of guilt or a sense of responsibility about that period.
Very definitely. And I think you see that from, I mean, I look in the book in great detail at the number of instances that that he's come out with these lines about God never being tired of forgiving us, it's just that we are tired of asking. Mm. When he was elected Pope, the traditional thing, and it's all done in Latin, you know, the traditional thing is that you're asked, if you accept the election and you say, accepto, he didn't say that. He said, I'm a sinner, but trusting in God's mercy and forgiveness, I accept. So even at the very moment of his election as Pope, it was there in his mind that that he had things to atone for.
We know that he was, well, we're told that he was the runner-up in the last conclave, the conclave that produced Benedict. There was a campaign to try to stop him becoming Pope even at that point.
There was. Even about 3 or 4 days before the cardinals were due to meet to begin their deliberations over who should be the successor to John Paul II, an email was sent round a lot of cardinals, not all of them, but a lot of them got an email containing a kind of dossier about how guilty he was over the incident with the Jesuits. And from what I can gather, it was very overstated. But nonetheless, it did the job. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he might not have got elected anyway, because Ratzinger was in a very strong position at that point.
Sure. Now, the images that we have here, using language like authoritarian to describe his personality at this point in his life, that contrasts remarkably with what people have seen of Pope Francis since he became Pope. This personification of humility, even this past week in his visit to Brazil, making comments about gay people that have impressed people around the world as warmer than we've ever heard at that kind of official level before. How do you explain this switch from authoritarian to humble?
At the end of the 15 years, the Jesuits in Rome decided that the split was so bitter between the pro and anti factions in Argentina that they moved him out of the country, and eventually they had to put a foreigner in to heal this division. It was so deep. And he went off to Germany, and he came back and he was given a job as an ordinary priest in Buenos Aires. But he kept kind of saying things as though he was the leader, and he cheesed everybody off. And so they sent him off into exile to Cordoba, which is 400 miles away, where he was just an ordinary priest. And he was there for several years. And this whole period of what was described to me by one of his close aides as exile, a period of humiliation and penance, lasted 7 years in total. And during it, because he's a man of deep prayer, he prays for 2 hours every day before his day begins. And in that time, he underwent a change. And he obviously decided that in his conversations with God, that God was telling him that he'd not been doing it right, and this kind of way of being a leader was wrong. And when he came out of that, and he was made a bishop in Buenos Aires, he had an entirely different leadership style. He was consultative, listening, wanted people to participate. And as he worked in the slums, which is the work he prioritised for himself, as he worked in the slums and met more and more people, more and more poor people, his attitude again softened and changed, and he ended up supporting all the things that he'd been put in to clamp down on 2 decades before.
Your book makes a very strong case for the fascination that we all have about this intriguing person, Pope Francis. I wonder, Paul, where it goes from here on the basis of what you've discovered about the exile period and the transformation in him. He speaks off the cuff. He scares some of the Vatican bureaucracy at times with what he says and what he's prepared to say. Could this be another John the 23rd situation where a pope makes a statement that transforms perhaps the declaration of a council or something like that, which could transform the church significantly?
I think so. I mean, the organisation that he set up to have 9 cardinals from and archbishops from around the world advising him on what, as it were, hearing messages from them around the world in his left ear while he's getting the messages in his right ear from the Vatican bureaucracy. One church historian described that as the biggest change in the Catholic Church for 10 centuries. Now, I think that's probably slightly overstated, but I don't think comparing him to John the 23rd is the right thing. He's his own man. But I think what my book shows is that there are two men hiding in the past of Bergoglio, and they're both still there. And he has this, you know, very strong convictions.
Very briefly, Paul.
Yeah, he's got this kind of ability to be domineering, but he's also, and it's genuine, he's become this person of humility. It's a kind of intellectual conversion to humility, but they're both still there. So he's tough enough to do what he needs to do in the Vatican, but he's humble enough to listen.
Paul Vallely, the author of Pope Francis on Tying the Knot. It's published by Bloomsbury Continuum. I think it's the best biography of the new Pope that has yet been published in these last few weeks. Thank you very much, Paul, for talking to us this morning.